Hello everyone and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Thursday, May 22, 2025. I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Wahid Ahmed, and we really do have a packed show for you today. We're going to give you all the highlights from day two of Qatar's Economic Forum. We're also going to discuss how Flynas has set its final price for its IPO. And the U.S. has officially accepted the Qatari jet as Trump's Air Force One. And finally, Modify has officially appointed a new CEO, Lana Suarez.
And the very first story of the day is Qatar Economic Forum. The day one was exciting, exhilarating, whatever word you can put on it. And day two was equally like that. And today is day three. But at the Qatar Economic Forum, Donald Trump Jr. was there, and he sparked speculation about a political future as the president of the U.S. When asked if he'd consider following in his father's footsteps as the U.S. president, he replied, "I don't know, maybe one day." For now, he says he's focused on running 1789 Capital, a firm that backs conservative-leaning companies. He praised the Gulf region's business climate, calling it rational investment, compared to what he described as Europe's oppressive regulatory climate.
Shady. His Highness Sheikh Saud Salim Al Sabah, head of Kuwait's $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund, didn't hold back on the challenges facing private equity. He warned that private equity is very troubled, pointing to inflated valuations and the rise of continuation of vehicles, with IPOs slowing and deals stalling. He said investors are now asking for their money back, but he noted opportunity in secondaries and special situations, areas where firms are pressured to sell.
And on the real estate front, Qatar is aiming high. Khalid Al-Ubaidli, president of Real Estate Regulatory Authority in Qatar, said he's engaging with global institutional players from the QIA, which is Qatar Investment Authority, to the likes of Blackstone and Brookfield, to position Qatar as a world-class real estate investment hub.
And Qatar Airways CEO Badr Almir says Airbus still has a shot at future jet orders. This despite Qatar recently striking a major 210 jet deal with Boeing. Almir confirmed Qatar will keep Airbus for short-haul flights and drop the Boeing 737 MAX.
And British financier Amanda Staveley had a stark warning for the UK. She says London's elite areas are growing concerningly quiet, blaming uncompetitive financial policies for the exodus of wealthy residents to the Middle East.
I think with this story, Majid, what stood out to me, let me just get his name, is what Sheikh Saud Salim Al Sabah was saying. Because, by the way, I think that we're truly facing some kind of recession. I mean, look at people's obsession with Labubus.
Yeah.
I really sat there and I thought about it. You know, why are people obsessed with this toy from Pop Mart, developed by this Hong Kong artist, forgot his name. But, you know, why are people so obsessed with this doll, with this, like, really ugly grin and really ugly face? And that is because they want to feel like they can afford luxury. You know, if you have that many people who are buying such a doll, that's because they feel like they can't get luxurious things. They don't have the money for those luxurious things. And that's why they're going after Labubus, to make themselves feel like they bought something that's expensive. Exactly. It has worth, but they can also afford it. I think that's really what it is. It's like kind of like the lipstick theory. I think that's what they call it. But I think he had a really good point there. But not to make people panic, I think everything is good.
I think his name is Kasing Lung. I just saw your PTC and found it out.
Yeah.
But the private equity market, he's very right that some startups in the region are overvalued. They just come, they promise something big. And when you put money into them, for 5 years, they disappear. They're like, okay, we'll give you something. So I think his idea is that contractually, you should ask people. I remember, I can't tell you the name of the founder or the guy who invested, but he invested in a startup And he didn't read the contract as much because he believed in the idea of the startup. And the startup is doing good, to be honest.
Do you remember what the startup is called?
I can't name anything. It's a very secret story. But I'll just tell you the crux of it. I'll tell you after the show the whole story. But the main idea was that in the contract, it was written that after 5 years, they'll get anything out of the money that they've invested. So it was a very long deal and like putting so much money. I don't know what the money was, to be honest. But at least putting something into a startup and then just sleeping on that money for 5 years is very difficult because nowadays, every VC, every fund, the Global Venture Story, we have a Global Venture Story. Today, Noor Swades will go live on our social, just giving you a heads up. They've invested in an Arabic language startup, 15 million. So all these people who are investing into startups, they now want something out in the first year. At least, or they want to cash out in the next 2 years. So they're just going.
I get it, Majid, because it's like you know. I remember I saw Noor Swades saying basically she leads Global Ventures, and they invested in Tabby, and Tabby in just 4 years, Hussein was able to turn it into a unicorn, into being valued at $1 billion. Now today it's valued at $3 billion. But I understand why you have people like that who just want returns in a year. Yeah. Because in their head, they're like, okay, Noor Swades got so many returns by backing Hussein on Tabby. You know, why can't I? I honestly, there are high expectations.
It's kind of like competition also. You're very right that it's basic human nature that I'm investing $10 million in a startup. Another person is investing $10 million. Their startup gives them returns or at least something after a year. Returns can be in any form. Basically, the evaluation of the startup can become big or something. But not every startup goes to the unicorn stage. Tabby was like one of the first in the market, so they had an advantage. Now, any startup that you see that's coming out, it's kind of like a copy of the startup that had already made sense in the Middle Eastern market. Let's not talk about global. Let's just, if we talk about Middle Eastern market, a lot of startups that now I see, they have the same product that already three people in the region are offering from Egypt, UAE, Saudi. Someone is already offering that. They just come in to the market, they get one or two clients, and they build the whole startup idea around those clients. 2 or 3 days ago, I received a parcel, and usually whenever I receive a parcel, it's from one of the common names, an Amex or someone. But 2 or 3 days ago, I got a parcel, and it was from QuickUp. And QuickUp recently got also a funding. So the funny thing was that they are going in to the market. They are disrupting the market, but they are not completely taking over the market. So the startups, whoever is like thinking of an idea right now, it's good to go in a saturated market where you already know a product is working and you make your own. I won't say copy, I think is a bad word, but you make your own version of it. But don't think that, don't go to the investors and lie to them that, oh, this is revolutionary. It's already being done. It's already in the market with three other companies.
You know
so
what it
I
is,
think
Magic?
This is the whole idea that private, that startups, one, any startup that you now see, just go make a simple chat search, ChatGPT search, Grok search, or Google search if you're still using Google. But you'll find someone doing the same thing.
You know what it also is, Majid? I feel like this is also kind of the negative aspect of transparency. Now, there is so much transparency, I feel now, over business deals, just over everything because of social media. And people can see everything that's happening. People can see the funding that's going into everything. And I feel like this also does go against these Arab entrepreneurs because what? We love privacy. Yeah. We love being very private. So it's, you know, the fact that you can see everything, you can see all the money certain companies are getting and all the returns that they're getting. If an investor does choose you and you don't get those same returns, it's just going to be, I feel that it's going to cause that. I understand why, you know, these investors are pulling out. There's so much transparency. There's so much great companies that are doing really well. And then you have like platforms like Sarwa where you can invest and you can do it safely without that much loss.
Yeah, but I think with all the funding news, we get a lot of funding news like every week. At least we see two or three startups getting funded. And mostly, most of them are pre-seed, seed, or Series A. Very rarely you see Tabby going for Series D or E. Very rarely you see a very well-established startup going for a funding. But all of these people are getting money. I think they use these PRs, this marketing, as a tool. They actually now, to be honest, for me, if I was funded, I would be happy to get the money and start using the product. Now, what I've realized over the years, over the last 2 years at least, what I've seen this industry very deeply, the startups are using the funding news as a marketing tool. They're not thinking, oh, we're getting money and we'll make our product better, we'll make this better, that better.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, the funding news has become a marketing tool for them. And, oh, we got funded by this big VC firm, so imagine we're so big. No, I didn't know about you before the funding news came. So that's the idea for startups. They're thinking that getting a funding from one of the big names, Shuru Partners, Global Ventures, anyone, will make them more popular and people will start using them. No, the product at the end of the day needs to be for the people, whoever your niche market is.
That's a really good point. And it's like, by the way, like with local people, your normal daily average people, not everyone is smart enough to, you know, go search who's BCO Capital or who's STV or who is this fund that just gave you this money. They care about the product that you're giving. Is it working for them? If it's not, absolutely next.
However,
there are so many companies.
Much funding you get, whatever you do, however you spend on your marketing, it's not going to work. The product needs to be the primary focus.
Absolutely.
Talking about product, Saudi Arabia's low-cost carrier, Flynas, has successfully priced its initial public offering at 80 riyals per share, the top of its marketing range, raising 4.1 billion Saudi riyals, or approximately $1.1 billion. The IPO will see Flynas and its current shareholders offload a 30% stake in the company, amounting to over 51 million shares.
I feel like we've been hearing about Flynas for like the longest time ever. Now, the offering includes shares from high-profile stakeholders such as Kingdom Holding Company, owned by Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, also the richest man in the Middle East, according to Forbes, with a net worth of $16.5 billion, and National Flight Services Company. Now, investor demand was, you know, allegedly overwhelming, with institutional subscriptions covering nearly 100 times, precisely 99.8, with minutes of opening.
And the IPO is yet another sign of rising investor confidence across the Gulf region as global market conditions show signs of stabilization. Flynas plans to channel the proceeds into expanding its fleet and launching new operational hubs, directly supporting Saudi Arabia's broader Vision 2030 goals for aviation and tourism.
Now, the listing comes on the heels of several other successful IPOs in the region, including a specialized medical company, which we discussed recently, United Carton Industries, and Dubai's Holdings Right, all of which were significantly oversubscribed. Now, analysts say the Gulf IPO pipeline remains strong, particularly in sectors aligned with the national transformation agendas.
And Flynas will now debut on the Saudi stock exchange, Tadawul, marking a major milestone in the kingdom's push to deepen its capital markets. The spotlight now turns to how effectively the airline can deploy the new capital to grow its market share, both regionally and internationally. The very interesting thing is that we talked about Dubai REIT. They were oversubscribed 26 times. We did a video with them yesterday. And Flynas was oversubscribed more than 100 times.
That's crazy.
Again, it's again a marketing tool. I don't know why.
How is it a marketing tool?
Yeah, again, I don't know why IPOs are marketing their oversubscription. Because now you set a final price. You've already sold the shares. You're listing. But I think it's just to... when the market opens, like DFM, 28 May, Dubai Presidential REIT, which is by Dubai Holdings, will list on DFM. I think as soon as it opens, they don't just want it to drop. So if it start, they've priced it at the higher range, 1.10 dirhams per share. So as soon as the market opens, you actually then see what the whole process has brought you. So it's good marketing, and people will want to buy it.
I can't lie. That did excite me, Majid.
Yeah.
I heard oversubscribed up to 100 times, and I was like, ooh, I need to join.
Yesterday, I had a very long and interesting chat with one of our commercial people in the office, Aziz, and he was like, what is oversubscription? What is an IPO? I had to explain him the whole process. He was like, no, I want to know. Process is complicated for a lot of people who don't understand what an IPO is. To be honest, it's complicated if you're not related to it. But very simply, a company comes up, they say we have 100 parts of our company and we're selling 30 parts. This is what Flynas did, 30 parts. And 30 parts, then they hire banks, they hire institutions who take calls from people, from big companies, from retail investors like you and me. And then the price range is set. 1.07 to 1.10 was Dubai residential REIT. And for example, you go and you're like, I'll buy 10,000 shares for 1.08. So they take all the prices from different people. This process is called book building. So they build the whole work. Usually, initially it was written down, so it's called book building. Now it's all on Excel sheets and whatnot sheets. So that's the book building process. And as soon as everyone puts in their bid, like, I will buy it for 1.09, someone actually goes in and says, well, I will buy at 1.10. So then they take all the bids and see, oh, this is the amount that is most common. So they take out an average, to be honest, and they realize, oh, 1.10 is where we can sell all shares.
Mm.
So then they give it to the people who bid at 1.10. And they all get allotments as soon as it lists on the market. So then you own, like, if you bought 10,000 shares for 1.10, as soon as the thing goes on the market, DFM, you'll get those 10,000 shares. Now it's on you. You want to keep them for 10 years, see if they grow up to 5 dirham, 10 dirham per share, or you want to sell it at 1.12.
So Majid,
that's the whole process.
Majid, I can't lie. People need a dumb it down business series from you. They do.
Need.
I mean,
everyone needs it. I also learned it, so it's not something complicated.
No, but you explain it really well, though. You really do. So
that's the short form, to be honest.
Yes, it is. Moving to our next story. Officially, the United States has accepted a luxury Boeing 747-8 jet from Qatar to serve as a future Air Force One for President Donald Trump. Now, the Pentagon confirmed that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth formally accepted the 12-year-old aircraft and has tasked the U.S. Air Force with preparing it for presidential use.
The move has ignited a political firestorm. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called it the largest bribe from a foreign government in American history, while others argue it raises serious legal and ethical questions. Despite concerns, Trump defended the decision, saying it would be stupid not to accept the jet.
Honestly, he's right. Now, the jet, once priced at $400 million when new, now holds a significantly lower resale value. But converting the aircraft to meet Air Force One standards will be a costly and complex task. Now, experts estimate the retrofit could exceed $1 billion, including missile defense systems, secure communications, and reinforced shielding.
And critics argue the U.S. already has two operational Air Force One aircraft and question the necessity of retrofitting a foreign-owned jet. Democratic Senators Mazie Hirono and Tammy Duckworth voiced concerns over national security risks, suggesting the jet may not be safe for international travel without extensive upgrades.
Now, the Pentagon hasn't disclosed how long the conversion will take or the final cost. Meanwhile, Boeing is already behind schedule on its current Air Force One program, which has ballooned to over $5 billion. Now, the new Qatar jet adds another layer of complexity to the evolving presidential fleet strategy. But more so than that, we've been hearing about this for a while now.
Yeah.
First, during Donald Trump's visit to the Gulf, we heard that Qatar is possibly giving him this Air Force One plane. And honestly, Trump is right to accept it. Number one, it's free.
Yeah.
Why would you say no to something for free? Like, why would you
His
do
logic
that?
Logic works.
No,
like,
no, seriously.
We give so many gifts. Why can't we accept gifts?
Also, it's kind of this thing. I know that a lot of people have this logic of, ooh, like, I should be afraid of accepting something because what if they come back and they're like, we want something from you? Okay, you don't have to say yes if it does not agree with your moral compass Also, it's rude to not accept something from Arab people. Like, even in my own household, my grannies will kill you if you do not accept food from them, if you don't accept gifts from them.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that Donald Trump accepted it, and he, you know, he didn't listen to the Republicans. I think it's a very good gift. Plus, isn't it? It was over 10 years old, Majid.
Yeah, it was used by a Qatari royal, so a lot of context.
But
a lot of context needed. The thing is that it was used by a Qatari royal. He saw it at a U.S. airbase. And he immediately fell in love with it. He saw it like 2 or 3 years ago. So that's where he actually saw it. And then he was like, I want it. Qatar PM on the first day of Qatar Economic Forum also defended it. Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman bin Jassim bin Jaber Al Thani. That's the name of the Qatar PM. Very long name. So I Googled it. But he was very clear. That was like the first opening, what would you call it, fireside chat. So Qatar Economic Forum, he said very clearly that it's a deal between Department of Defense on both countries. So it's not a personal gift to Donald Trump from the Emir of Qatar. It's a Department of Defense deal between both Departments of Defense. So, and he's like, this is not the first time it's happening. These transactions always happen between allies. So as soon as I heard that, it reminded me of the transaction between UAE and Pakistan. I remember there was a time like 3-4 years ago after COVID where Pakistan was facing a lot of money problems, and UAE and Saudi stepped in and they gave oil to Pakistan on deferred payment, on late payments. So they gave the oil and we paid it to them like after 3-4 years. So this is like just an example of transactions which happen between allies and friendly countries. So giving a jet is not a problem. So 400 million was the new price. I read it somewhere that 100 million is now, right now, its evaluation.
Okay.
So 100 million, but the problem is just making it usable is going to cost them nearly 1 billion.
And it takes like, per hour, it takes like $175,000 to $200,000 for the Air Force One plane to run.
So all these things are there. It's a very clear gift. It's not, I think the West doesn't understand the idea of Arabic gifting, as you said. They don't understand
because
that we'll give you anything.
It's because if you, like, say you, what's it called, a friend, like an American friend paid something for you and it was $2, they'll ask you to PayPal it. That's why. They'll ask you to return it immediately. It's because I feel like this is a, you know, the kind of logic that they live in.
Just a very nice story that I remember. Just to give you an Islamic perspective of our culture as well. I remember there's a hadith where the Prophet, once he had only one, I think, what's it called, a goat baby, and it was there in his house, and suddenly in the evening some guests came. I don't remember which wife's house he was there. So she asked him, like, guests, what do we do? And that was the last one. So they sacrificed it and made food for the guests. So this is how high hospitality and being good to your guests goes, from the best man in Islam, the best man to follow. So Prophet sacrificed the only goat he had to give it to their guests. He didn't think about what will happen tomorrow, what will we do. So this is how high hospitality goes. So I don't think West gets this idea. So that is why it's become such a big problem. And
no, they definitely don't get that idea. And it's like, I think that's why they also definitely don't understand. A lot of them, I feel, that Disneyland Abu Dhabi is going to be extremely successful. Like, Majid, I find it so surprising that, you know, this Western journalist, you know, he basically went on LinkedIn. He's a travel journalist. You know, he does good work, so I won't say his name, but he basically went on LinkedIn and he was like, oh, you know, apparently Disneyland Abu Dhabi has been in the works since 2019 and it had like a special operations name. And then he went to say, but I'm concerned about how the park is going to deal with the scorching heat. And there was another point that he made, but I don't exactly remember it, but it was so strange for him to say that, because have we seen the parks in the UAE? Have we seen the parks in Yas Island? Have we seen the malls, the buses in the UAE? They are all perfectly air-conditioned. I you know, out of all countries, the UAE deals with temperatures really well. Like, I told you this before, Majid. When I went to Paris Disneyland, It was like peak summer in Paris, and there was no air conditioning on the buses. I remember when I was in Disneyland Paris, they still can't handle the heat, and people were jumping in fountains. I'm serious.
Yeah, people do
white
that.
People were literally jumping into the fountains, and I remember just me and my family being like, oh.
What's happening?
That's like really inappropriate. But anyways, my point is that, number one, the park is going to be indoor, I believe.
You got to ask. See, the answer to all these questions is, have you been to Yas Island? And that's what the Miral CEO also said. Have you been to Yas Island? You go to WB, you go to SeaWorld. SeaWorld is completely inside. Only the roller coaster, the sitting part is inside, and then the roller coaster goes outside and then you come inside again. So it's all air conditioned.
Yeah.
I don't know who these people are. They have never traveled to, I think, UAE or at least the Middle East, like Saudi.
He's based here.
Yeah.
Apparently he's based here. And I feel like what you know, his commentary, it was just so nonsensical.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that if you look at Miral, the company that's going to be funding, building, and operating Disneyland with Disney, Disney just earning royalties, they have such a beautiful track record. Yeah. As you said, they have SeaWorld, they have Ferrari World, they have Warner Bros. World. So they have such a successful track record that your argument has no merit of can they handle the heat.
I think we should gift him a free ticket whenever we get something in partnership.
Yes,
we'll
should.
Gift you a ticket. You
yes,
go there.
Should.
You see what's happening there. It's very nice. I went to SeaWorld in summers for the first time and I literally couldn't feel the heat. It's so nicely built. Any place you go to, I've been to Legoland in Dubai, it's in Dubai, but I've been to all these places. You go and you don't feel it. Obviously, if it's too crowded, you go to the coldest place in the world.
Mm.
If it's too crowded, it will always feel a little bit hot. But they have like penguins in SeaWorld, so if there is a heat problem, how are they surviving? So it's very nonsensical, to be honest. To make these comments, it's just like them trying to play it down. Oh, now people will not think of the American dream and be like, oh, we want to go to Disneyland. They'll just come to Abu Dhabi. And the visa is free, so easy for a lot of countries, free for a lot of countries. I think they're just jealous that now people will stop going there and come back here.
I think you know what it also is, Majid? I think that someone brought up this really good point of it's not Miral, it's not Abu Dhabi, that Yas Island that has to be worried. It's Disney that has to be worried because apparently it's Disney that's like designing the entire thing.
They lose all traffic everywhere, right?
They need to make sure that they abide by the UAE laws. They need to make sure that they bring in characters, customs that align with our culture and that they understand our culture. It's going to be exciting to see how they do that. But speaking of cultures, the media landscape in the UAE is really changing. The fintech media platform Monify has officially appointed Lana Suarez as its new chief executive officer, signaling such a major shift in its strategy. Now, the announcement marks a fresh chapter for the startup, which was founded by Egyptian billionaire Naguib Suarez, a part of the richest family in Africa, not just Egypt, in November 2024.
And Monify originally launched with a mission to deliver financial content tailored to Gen Z and younger audiences across emerging markets, backed by around $50 million in funding. It quickly gained attention with its bold youth-focused approach and high-profile media hires. They literally hired all across the globe.
Yes, they did. They had Upton. They had, I believe, the...
They flew in people from London, UK. We'll go on and tell you the whole story.
Yeah, we will. So under Lana Suarez's leadership, the platform is now pivoting toward a video-first model with a focus on short-form content and financial literacy. Now, Suarez brings branding and consumer experience with her from luxury names like Christian Louboutin and Keith, and is expected to drive the transition toward mobile-first and social-first financial storytelling.
And before Lana's appointment, Monify was led by former Euronews CEO Michael Peters. However, we previously broke the news that the company laid off nearly 100 employees. We broke this in February, and they laid off nearly 100 employees just months after launch. So November 2024, they launched. By February, they had fired 100 plus people. So, and they have fired the top media talent also. So the internal shakeup marked a significant setback for the high-profile venture.
And now, with a new CEO at the helm, and a redefined strategy, Monify is really aiming to regain momentum, which is normal. It's a startup. It was just launched last November, as we told you guys. And, you know, this is just reflecting broader industry trends as legacy models give way to content platforms building around speed, scale, and digital native storytelling.
I remember the very important point in all of this is you get 50 million funding, no, not a problem. We started the show by talking about startups also. Whenever you have a startup, money will come in. People in this region, they're ready to spend, they're ready to invest in startups. The problem is, how would you earn? So the press release that came out when they were launched in November, it very clearly stated three ways they'll earn money. So the first one was we'll do paid website access, so paywalled access to their website. Has never worked in history. You go to Guardian, you just read any article, and at the end of that article, Guardian will be like, oh, we do such nice journalism, so just pay us £1 for the subscription and blah and blah. So even if Guardian can't do it, Arabian Business, I don't want to name them, but it's a very interesting case that I saw. Even their marketing material, their own press releases for their events are paywalled. So right now, if you're listening, go to Arabian Business, try to access one of the press releases on their website. They're paywalled. So they're putting their press releases, so they're not doing it properly. It's an operational development problem.
Yeah.
You talk about Financial Times. A lot of people, I think, will pay to read it because they go so deep. And if you have read their long-form pieces, they actually give you a lot of. But still, those prices are like £1, $2, $5. So paywalled content doesn't give you millions in money yearly. A lot of publications like Bloomberg is good. Bloomberg is paywalled. But actually, the money comes from Bloomberg Terminal. It has $25,000, nearly $19,000 to $25,000 price range for however many things you take for the Bloomberg Terminal only. The Bloomberg website is very cheap. It's like, I think, $10 or $9. So you don't make a lot of money from paywall. That was their first problem.
Yeah.
Second problem was they said, we'll do events. Okay, events are money-throwing businesses, and then you get money.
Where did they say that they're going to do events?
On the press release. So they had 3 points. How will they make money? So there was this guy who was brought in to just launch the project. So he was with them for nearly 1.5 year. And he launched the whole project and then left. He was the executive assistant or executive something to Naguib Sawaris himself. I forgot the name. We did his reaction. He was also very sad about the 100 people being fired. He was quoted by everyone in the press release that this is. And then third was partnerships. So I understand partnerships. We also do partnerships on Smashy Business. But those are paid partnerships. So I think partnerships was the only point that made sense. Mm. And partnerships is not partnerships. It's basically selling your space, your videos, your carousels, your whole like geography that you have on social. You sell those places. You just sell spots. Mm. We at Love in Dubai, our main company, the big company under Augustus
Bigger
Media.
Bigger sister of Smashy. Yeah,
we sell our logo reformations. We sell our top three pinned posts.
Yeah.
We literally sell our stories. We sell everything.
Mm.
So that was the only point that made sense, and they haven't done that.
But see, Majid, it is very justifiable though, because the company was launched just last year in November. But like as I told you, it does not come down to the people.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people have a lot of great potential, and the longer that they stay in companies, the better that they do and the better that they succeed. It's just overhiring. As that case that you brought up, Microsoft basically fired 3% of its staff.
1,000 people.
Really?
6%.
No, I thought it was 3% and it was 6,000 people.
6%, 1,000. That's they fired a lot of people.
Wait, let's confirm this.
Yeah.
Did Microsoft
I think it was 6%
fire.
And 1,000 people. But yeah.
Yes, so. Majid. Microsoft laid off 3% of its workforce. And it was 6,000 workers. So it's like, as I told you before, I think that it all comes down to company policy and overhiring. Don't overhire, you know, because a giving hand can also be the same hand that will pull back opportunities. You need to be careful, especially with the kind of market that we're in right now. So I think it's just with policy.
Yeah. You are right, I'm right. So 1,000 was June
2024. Oh, okay.
I remember that number. Sorry, my mistake.
Wow.
But yeah,
so
recent was 6,000.
They've been firing a lot of 7,000 people. It's been consecutive. But I think with this case, it's just more of don't overhire. And
yeah.
It's a new company. It has a lot of potential. But going back to the new CEO that they appointed, Lana Suarez,
yeah.
We can clearly see that there is probably a link between her and the Suarez family.
Yeah, we tried to
very,
find it.
Very probable. We have not found it.
Yeah, we will try to find it.
Just to tell you guys about her experience, she was basically the global digital communications manager for Christian Louboutin, the art director for Kith, and she was also a founder and the CEO of this company called And Lana. So it's basically like a creative incubator committed to developing emerging and established brands. Really interesting, and it's based in New York. And then also, she was actually appointed chief brand officers of Naguib Suarez's new real estate company, Aura Developers. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know how she's juggling all of this all at once.
She's the daughter of Naguib.
I think,
yeah,
really?
I just found.
Oh, okay.
So she is the daughter of Naguib Suarez.
That's really interesting.
Nice.
But she does do a lot. Not sure if this experience will determine if she is ready to lead a media company.
Yeah.
But hey, I never worked in media before. So I think it's going to be interesting to see the kind of change that she does bring in. She does seem very humble and sweet.
Let's see. Yeah. But it's good that they've laid out the policy now that it's going to be video content. It's going to be short form content. It's going to target Gen Z. Very nice pointers that they've made. And also, they're only focusing on financial literacy. So the thing that I did today with IPO, trying to explain it, they're going to do that. It's a nice thing. We actually need financial literacy a lot in the Middle East since it's becoming the capital of the world, the capital of the world. Abu Dhabi has that moniker with it, but I think the whole region can be called the capital of the world. But good to know that. To be honest, we did the story and we got a little bit of backlash from people that, oh, why are you not talking about their goods? But they're doing good.
Or that we're milking it too much.
We're like Saudi and UAE. We love competition, but we want to grow constructively with each other. We're not pulling anyone down. We're just growing together. And whoever joins the media landscape in the UAE, we would always welcome them. We would report on them.
No, it was a big story. It was a big story. Like,
and then
allegedly,
Semaphore later, you remember? They were like,
Semaphore also,
we broke it.
Yeah, Semaphore also reported on it. And there was a source close to the matter that did inform Smashy Business that they sacked 80% of their staff. So it was a very big story. And thank you so much for listening, everyone. That's a wrap for today. Make sure to follow us across all social media channels at Smashy Business and stay ahead with our daily newsletter. You'll find a subscription link in the description.
This has been a Smashy Business show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. A big shout out to our 1.5 million monthly listeners across all platforms. You make this possible. If you're one of them, we appreciate you. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.